Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Dr. Arar Ahmad is professor emeritus at Black Hills State University. He says there is increasing awkwardness in the relationship between Islamic countries and the West. He joins us today to talk about negative perceptions of Islam and what can be done to provide clarity. All this is ahead of a lecture he's giving tonight at Black Hills State University, Rapid City. Dr. Ahmad, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thank you, Lori. I'm delighted and honored and grateful to be here.
So let's talk about this lecture series tonight. Why this topic and why now? What makes you feel like this is a particularly pertinent topic to talk about today?
Because I think, Lori, that we are seeing increasing manifestations of awkwardness, antipathy, wariness, suspicion about Muslims. It is being expressed in very different ways, and sometimes very loudly and aggressively. And so it is, I think, necessary that we must try to clarify certain things so that we are not swept into that kind of thinking, that kind of attitude or those sentiments.
Now, you came here in the 70s, is that correct?
Right.
So has that changed over the decades?
Have you seen it? I think it has. It has, and it's interesting. I was looking, as part of my preparation for this, I was looking at the history of this phenomenon, anti-Islamic sentiments in the country, what some people call Islamophobia. I don't like the term, but nonetheless. And there are certain interesting features that has developed over time. For example, it began in the 1980s and gained momentum in the 90s, even when the relationship between Islam and terrorism had not been fully developed or established. So even at that time, people began to talk about Muslims as being more fanatical, they do not value life, they're treacherous, intolerant, violent, and so on. What is also interesting is that it's not merely crude representations in the media or popular consciousness. Even scholars began to talk about it. People like Professor Richard Rodman, Daniel Pipes, Bernard Lewis, Samuel Huntington, they also began to talk about this imminent and inevitable clash of civilizations where these two, Islam and the West, are simply incompatible and one cannot live and coexist with the other. And the third interesting thing about this phenomenon that I noticed is that the explanations of extremism and violence has evolved over time. Initially in the 1980s, extremist violence would be looked at from the perspective of criminal psychology. That is, it was deviant behavior, the action of psychopaths, irrational, maladjusted, and so on. By 1990s, it had turned into, from the psychological to socioeconomic conditions, looking at such things like education, economic opportunities, broken families, social marginalization, things like that. But when Islamic groups became the main purveyors of this kind of atrocious behavior, the narrative shifted to almost a monocausal explanation in the sense that it was held that Islam itself was responsible. Islam teaches violence and fanaticism and hatred, and the faith itself generates and drives this kind of behavior, atrocious, violent, brutal, inhuman, criminal behavior that we see in some parts of the Muslim world, reflected in some parts in the West as well.
So I'm curious about something you said about scholars sort of buying into this or showing up in the scholarship. Why would that be? I get sort of a popular culture misperceptions, but I'm having a hard time with the academic angle of that.
Right. It's very, very intriguing. It's very difficult to understand. But clearly they were looking at trends and they were thinking about the future and they were assuming that this, as Samuel Huntington, who said that the problem is not Islamic fundamentalism, it is Islam itself. And this is said in 1993, much before Islam's emergence as the main purveyor of terrorism and violence in the world. And I suspect that they were simply being honest scholars. They were looking at a phenomenon. They were afraid of what it would do and where it would go. And consequently, they were trying to understand it, explain it, and perhaps warn others about the kind of difficulties that they thought would be inevitable in the long run.
Do you think their scholarship created more problems?
I don't think it created more problems, but it certainly reinforced it in the sense that it was not just sensationalist media that we could blame or crude things that people were saying in back rooms. This had now the veneer, the patina of scholarly observation, analysis, and judgment that was associated with it. So it gave it more gravitas. It gave it more importance.
And how early did you find in your research people sort of pushing back against that and saying, no, this is a misperception, a misinterpretation of what Islam is?
Right. By the game changer, Lori, was the absolutely horrible, terrible tragedy of 9/11. And it was after that that people began to realize that Islam was being hijacked, Islam was being corrupted, Islam was being maligned and besmirched by the very people who are acting in its name. And therefore, that became a much greater sensitivity in the Muslim world and among scholarships that this is not what it is supposed to be. This is not how it should be interpreted. This is not what it stands for. And consequently, the struggle for the soul of Islam, what Islam stands for, what it means, what it teaches, what its traditions are, became a much more important subject of study. So initially, from the early on in the 21st century, we began to see this this backlash against that earlier kind of a sentiment that was quite simple, perhaps simplistic, to something much more complex and a much more nuanced understanding of Islam and what it means and what it teaches.
So what you said, the struggle for the soul of Islam, is very poetic and interesting to me. What does the struggle for the soul of Islam look like?
It's awkward, it's messy, it's dangerous, because what is happening, obviously, Lori, is that some people acting in the name of Islam are doing absolutely horrible things, and they're justifying it on the basis of the fact that they think that they are doing what Islam tells them to do or teaches them to do. And for many of us in the West, this is absolutely, completely unacceptable. This is not what it is supposed to be. This is not what it means to us. This is not the Islam that we grew up with or the Islam that we believe in. And consequently, what does Islam stand for becomes an important question, because those people, those purveyors of hate and violence and criminality and brutality, they have the upper hand because they have the media. They use social media very successfully. They can have grisly scenes of beheadings and absolutely atrocious behavior, and it will be carried in the Western media very easily. And that's the impression, that's the image that people will have. On the other hand, the question of a tolerant, peaceful, understanding, inclusive Islam gets lost in this clutter and in this clamor of the actions of a few stupid criminals.
What does Islam stand for?
To me, it's a very complex religion, Lori. It wants to establish things like importance of the family, importance of community, importance of faith, importance of submission to God, importance of going about your business of life in as peaceful a manner as possible. If one looks at the great religions, the great monotheistic faiths, for example, in Christianity, the one word that will be more important than others will be the concept of love. God's love for Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ's love for us. So love will be probably the most operative word. In Judaism, it would probably be law, that it is, what are the legalities involved as far as the interpretation of the Torah and the Tanakh is concerned. In that, if we look at those important words that have become such important priorities as far as the faiths are concerned, then to me, the important word in Islam would be the word justice. It appears over and over again, be just. Justice is next to piety. Do not swerve away from justice, even when you're angry or you hate. Make sure that you treat people justly. That one word occurs much more, many more times than any other word that I have seen.
What are the first steps for people in the Western world to sort of deal with this phenomenon as it is currently presenting itself?
The most important thing, Lori, would be trying to educate oneself, trying to understand, keeping an open mind. I know it is difficult because Muslims make it very easy to hate them. When you see these pictures, when you hear these things of innocent people being killed in Brussels or in San Bernardino or cartoonists in Paris or in Denmark, or children being abducted, girls being abducted by the Boko Haram in Nigeria, or school children being killed in Pakistan, or just this weekend, a secular blogger was hacked to death in Bangladesh, the country that I come from. And you see these things, you hear these things, you're saturated with these things. It is So obviously, naturally, understandably, people will think that this is what it is. This is reinforced by the fact that there are these stupid pronouncements from these so-called Muslim leaders who will say the most outrageous things. They have very sophisticated recruitment strategies now. And so what was at one time a fairly easy thing, this is what Islam means, has now become a much more complicated exercise.
Hmm. Well, how do people who are not Islam in the Western world begin to approach this conversation?
With an open mind, which is why I say that the most important war that we can fight is the war against ignorance and prejudice. That, I think, is very, very important. And I think it is also important that perhaps even people in the media be a bit more responsible in the way in which things are portrayed. That even right now, Laurie, I don't want to be political, but even the pronouncement of some political leaders may reinforce that. And consequently, we have to be a lot more sensitive, a lot more understanding, a lot more enlightened, and we have to make an effort. It will not come easily. It is not natural. It is a very complex religion, like all the other monotheistic faiths, like Judaism is, like Christianity is. And therefore, one needs to make an effort to try to understand. And it is in encouraging people to make that effort that I think we must devote our attention to.
Talk to me a little bit about the notion of family and how that's important to Islam. It was one of the first things that you mentioned when I said, what does Islam stand for? You said family and the importance of family. Elaborate on that a little bit.
Right. So much of Islamic law, custom, tradition surrounds the notion of family, your responsibilities to your children, to your wife, to your parents, how your property will be divided. So there is an enormous amount of attention paid to family life, family health, family responsibility, what do people do in the family, the importance of maintaining, preserving, protecting your family. It's a continuing subtext in the Islamic text and tradition.
How broad does that reach? Is that an immediate family, an extended family?
Excellent question, Laurie. It usually refers to an immediate family, but it also includes things like your community. For example, it says that you cannot be, you cannot practice, you cannot be a just Muslim if people around you are needy and are hungry. So you extend your sense of compassion to include others as well. There are responsibilities to your community that you have. You cannot simply pile up wealth for yourself. You have to share it. The poor and the needy have an entitlement on your wealth. It's not a question of charity, but they have the right to it as well. So it extends a little more, but of course the nucleus is the immediate family, your kin.
And submission to God, you also mentioned.
And
I'm curious to know, what does that mean in a day-to-day life, submission to God?
For example, Laurie, Muslims are supposed to pray five times a day. They all face the direction of Mecca, and they prostrate themselves. They put their foreheads on the ground in terms of submitting completely, physically and spiritually to God. They do that five times a day. They go to the pilgrimage, which is an extended form of spiritual cleansing, as well as standing witness to their own submission and the submission of millions of others to the notion of God. So the sovereignty of God, the importance of God in the lives, the acceptance of God as the driving force in their lives, this is fundamental to Islamic thought and practice.
What has been your experience of practicing Islam in South Dakota?
I should be very honest here, Laurie. My practice observance of the faith is not very regular or rigorous. My wife is a practicing Muslim. I am a political scientist who studies Islam. I'm not an Islamic scholar. I just wanted to clarify that.
Oh, thank you for that.
But yes, it's not very difficult. Some of the things, for example, become a little problematic in a place where I live in Spearfish, because we were supposed to say at least one prayer in a week on Fridays, which is a congregational prayer, that you meet with others and you pray together. That is, of course, not possible. There are certain requirements about dietary restrictions, which is difficult to fulfill. Mm-hmm. And there are issues like that, small practical issues, but nonetheless, none that are insurmountable or overwhelming.
When it comes to a political science perspective, do you see elements of positivity or hope in these relationships between the West and Islamic countries?
I think so, Lori. I tend to be a little optimistic individual. I think this is a phase. For example, there's Islamic State warriors who engage in beheadings and kill each other and engage in absolutely atrocious, criminal, stupid behavior. I think this will pass. I think people will begin to understand, Muslims themselves will begin to realize that this is simply intolerable and has to be condemned, it has to be transcended, it has to be conquered. And therefore, once this process begins, both in the Islamic world and in the West, I think reconciliation, understanding, inclusiveness will be much easier.
And there's hope for the sort of clarification of the relationships and some...
And there is hope in terms of the clarification. What has happened, one of the things that has happened, Lori, is that because of social media, people can say almost anything. They can Photoshop, they can change, they can take selective words out of context and put them in, and people will start exchanging this and start believing it. And what also happens, Lori, is something in political science we refer to as confirmation bias. That is, we tend to remember and focus on those things that agree with our preconceived ideas. So once we start believing that Islam is violent, Islam is menacing, Islam is undemocratic, that's what we will pick up on. So everything will reinforce that idea. And consequently, it's difficult. It's a much arduous struggle. It is not a very simple thing to say that, oh, we'll just change our perspective and become a little more enlightened and let us sing around a campfire singing Kumbaya together. It is not as simple as that. It is, which is why I refer to it as a struggle for the soul of Islam. Muslims must realize it. They themselves must fight much more aggressively. They must condemn much more unambiguously these actions of a few. And they must reassert their own understanding and the peaceful traditions that Islam is originally supposed to stand for.
Let's go back and just get those highlights again. So unambiguous condemnation,
yes.
Reassertion of, say that again. You said reassert their...
I forget what I said, Lori.
It was really good. It was like a three-step process right there that you had kind of laid out. This sort of unambiguous condemnation and reassertion of, I think, peaceful practices or something
right.
In that.
The meaning, reassertion of the actual meaning of Islam and demonstrating that through their own practice, through their own example.
That's right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Dr. Arar Ahmad. Am I saying your name right, sir?
Perfect.
His lecture on Islam's Troubled Image, Some Reflections, Some Clarifications is tonight, 6:30 p.m. It's part of the academic lecture series held at Black Hills State University in Rapid City. That lecture is free. The public is invited to attend. Sir, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you so much. I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. You have been very kind, as people of Pakistan have been.